it has been a full circle, and you know, I have the greatest job in the world right now. It's been challenging, obviously, given the financial crisis, but we are making progress. Every month, every year is a little bit better than what came before, and I think what I'm going to tell you today is going to be very much consistent with that. Good morning. I'm very pleased to be back here in Puerto Rico to meet with you today. We've been having a number of conversations with bankers, business people, community development over the last 2 days. Each visit that I make here gives me a chance to deepen my relationship and understanding of the issues that are going on here. Last year, for example, I visited La Cantera and met with the community leaders, business people, academics, and bankers and government officials. This time, one of the highlights of my visits was I visited Goya Foods. It's the oldest Hispanic-owned plant in our country with a subsidiary of facilities in my home state of New Jersey and upstate New York. And I've been in the grocery store many times and seen Goya. It's always had a great reputation. And after seeing how careful and fastidious they are in terms of the production and how modern the facilities are, that brand is even elevated even further in my own mind. I was also really impressed by the breadth of products that they produce. It's really quite an impressive operation. I'm also meeting with people to talk about really what's going on here in the ground in terms of the economic and financial issues important to Puerto Ricans. And this is an important part of my job in terms of what I do at the Federal Reserve. It's important that I represent the constituency of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and that constituency does include the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. It's a little different than what's going on up north. As Kowser said, we actually have some snow up there. It seems like a bad April Fool's Day joke, but apparently it's really true. Coming here is also fun for me because I actually came here on vacation when I was a child, and I remember, I think I was probably about 14 years old, and I was playing golf on one of the golf courses here, and I was amazed how nice it was, and that was a real highlight of my childhood. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to speak at the Export Trade Basics Forum to help kick off a week-long summit on education, exports, and entrepreneurship that begins next week. I think it's a hugely important issue for the island. This morning, I'm going to talk about economic conditions in the mainland and in Puerto Rico, paying particular attention to developments since my visit last year, and I'm going to focus on the role of exports. As always, what I have to say reflects my own views and not necessarily the views of the Federal Open Market Committee or the Federal Reserve System. So by way of introduction, what I want to do is start with making some comments about what the New York Fed is, what we do, and what makes my job so interesting. The New York Fed is part of the Federal Reserve System, America's central bank, which was created by Congress in 1913, so we have a 100-year anniversary coming up. With this act in 1913, Congress delegated to the Federal Reserve its constitutional authority to manage the money supply in the nation's economy. And Congress designed the central bank actually to be decentralized, to be representative of all of the regions of the countries, including Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, and set it up in a way so that it'd be shielded from the political process. The Fed system consists of really two parts. There's the Board of Governors in Washington, D.C., which is headquarters. That's a federal agency led by Chairman Bernanke. Plus, there are 12 Federal Reserve banks that span the entire country. So the Federal Reserve Bank of New York is one of those 12, and we have unusual territory in our district. We have the 12 northern counties of New Jersey. We have Fairfield County, Connecticut. And we have all of New York, plus, of course, Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. So we probably have the most diverse Federal Reserve District. And in the wintertime, especially, I think it's a very attractive place to come and visit. Each Reserve Bank is distinct. Each bank has its own charter, and it has a board of directors drawn from its district. So on our board is Richard Carrion, Banco Popular, on our board of directors. And Kathy Wild, who's not Puerto Rican but comes here every month visiting, is also on our board of directors. So Puerto Rico gets quite a bit of representation on our board of directors. The law that created the Federal Reserve made the central bank independent so that policymakers could make decisions about monetary policy, such as whether to raise or lower interest rates. in the national interests, you know, somewhat insulated from political pressure. However, that said, the Fed is accountable to Congress. Congress set a very explicit objective for monetary policy: to pursue the highest level of employment consistent with price stability. So two goals. This objective is also referred to as our dual mandate because we have these two goals of both employment and low and stable inflation. In order to promote these objectives, we also pay very close attention to financial stability, because as we've seen through the crisis, that without financial stability, it's very hard to achieve our goals with respect to jobs and inflation. Now, the Federal Open Market Committee, which meets in Washington 8 times a year, consists of the Board of Governors, so the people from the headquarters in Washington, plus the presidents of each of the 12 Federal Reserve banks. As the current New York Fed president, I get a little special. I'm in a little bit special position. I get to be vice chair at these meetings. And what happens at these meetings is that each committee member presents his views about what's going on in the economy, and what he views the implications of what's happening in the economy and the outlook for the economy in terms of what should happen in terms of monetary policy. Now, in terms of assessing what's going on in the economy, we use a lot of economic data from our research departments, but we also talk to people in our district to find out what's really happening on the ground. Because oftentimes that economic information that we glean when we're traveling to places like San Juan today really is actually more timely in terms of what's happening right now. The board of directors are an important part of that. We also have regional advisory councils, and we have many, many conversations with a broad set of constituencies. You know, my visit to Puerto Rico is certainly part of that process, and it's really helpful for me to learn firsthand what really are the challenges and issues here in Puerto Rico. Now, one thing that makes my job even more interesting is that the New York Federal Reserve Bank is a little different than the other 11 Federal Reserve banks, because we're really the Reserve Bank that is actually charged with actually implementing monetary policy. So monetary policy decisions are made in Washington by the Federal Open Market Committee, but then someone has to make it so, and that's the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. This means that at the direction of the Federal Open Market Committee, we buy and sell Treasury securities to raise and lower interest rates. We also are important because we're the eyes and ears of the Fed on what's happening in terms of Wall Street and New York City. You know, New York is one of the major financial centers of the world, and we really keep a close eye on that. And we supervise some of the largest financial institutions, not only in the United States, but in the world. We also operate a lot of financial services. One of the most important one is Fedwire. That's a payment system, so when banks want to move large sums of money between each other, they use Fedwire, which we operate. And we also provide a lot of banking services for the U.S. Treasury and central banks around the world. New York Fed is actually the biggest repository of gold in the world. Unfortunately, it's not the United States gold, it's foreign gold, but foreign governments feel pretty comfortable keeping their gold with us. So if you ever come to New York Fed and want a tour of the gold vault, it's actually pretty interesting. All in all, there's a lot obviously going on in New York to keep me and my colleagues quite busy, even in normal times. And so the financial crisis was obviously quite challenging. So now I want to turn and talk a little bit about the U.S. economic outlook. What is the outlook for economic activity, employment, inflation on the mainland? And in particular, what are the areas of vulnerability that we should be most concerned about? Well, I'm pleased to report that the economic outlook for the mainland has improved over the last 6 months. That's the good news. But despite this, we're still very far away from achieving our dual mandate of maximum sustainable employment and price stability. Faster progress to those two goals would be very welcome. On the activity side, a wide range of indicators show a broadening and strengthening of demand by households and production by firms. For example, on the demand side, after an unusually deep retrenchment during the recession, consumer spending has begun to recover. And that recovery strengthened considerably during the last few months of 2010. Not surprisingly, as consumer demand rose, businesses' orders and production have also followed suit. So these factors led to growth about 3% in the fourth quarter of 2010. And growth for the first quarter looks likely to be very similar, around 3% plus or minus. So that's good. That's better than what we've seen. In my view, though, the revival in demand and production is not as strong as desired. But it does suggest that we're getting closer to the point where we'll actually reestablish a virtuous circle that will support stronger growth on a sustainable basis. What I have in mind is a cycle in which rising household and business demand leads to more employment growth. That supports income and confidence, which leads to further spending, which leads to more employment growth, et cetera, et cetera. And so you actually have a sustainable and vigorous economic recovery. This is why we upgraded our assessment of the economy at the last month's Federal Open Market Committee meeting, noting that the economy now is on, quote, a firmer footing, unquote. The major missing piece of the puzzle up until very recently has been the absence of strong payroll job growth. We really need to see that strong payroll job growth to really be confident that this virtuous circle is firmly in place. Now, with respect to the labor market, we have had some conflicting signals. On one hand, we've seen the unemployment rate come down quite sharply over the last 4 months. We were at 9.8% 4 months ago, and then with today's figures, we're at 8.8%. So we've seen a 1 percentage point drop in the unemployment rate in 4 months. That's pretty good. On the other hand, when we look at the payroll employment gains in terms of how many jobs are being added by the different businesses, that's been much more modest, and it has not been as impressive as the drop in the employment. These are two separate surveys, and that's why we can get two separate results. Now, the good news that we got today is that the latest data on payroll employment for March is somewhat better than what we've seen in prior months. The economy added 216,000 jobs in March. And the February job growth was also revised up a little bit. You know, particularly encouraging is the fact that we're actually seeing growth in manufacturing employment. Over the past year, we've added factory jobs at the fastest pace since the 1990s. So a pretty strong recovery in the manufacturing sector. And the other thing that makes us feel more optimistic is that it's not just the payroll gains that we're seeing, but the other labor market indicators are also showing improvement. So initial claims for unemployment insurance benefits are falling. And employment components of both manufacturing and non-manufacturing business surveys show that the improvement has continued recently. So there's still some uncertainty about what's going to happen in terms of the speed and power of the labor market recovery, but I am getting more optimistic. And I'm actually hopeful that the job gains that we'll see in future months will be even more sizable than what we've seen up to now. We need that. We would welcome it. Even if we were to generate growth in jobs of 300,000 per month, we would still have considerable slack in the labor market by the end of next year, by the end of 2012. So why is the economy finally showing more signs of life? Well, in my view, this improvement reflects three important developments. First, household and financial institution balance sheets continue to improve. On the household side, since 2008, we've seen a rise in the savings rate, which has brought us from virtually zero back into a 5 to 6% range. Meanwhile, the amount of money that households need to service their debts for mortgages, credit cards, car loans, has fallen sharply. We're now back at levels that prevailed during the mid-1990s. Debt service has been pushed lower by a whole host of factors, including debt repayment, refinancing at lower interest rates, and by debt charge-offs by banks. Financial institutions have strengthened their balance sheets by retained earnings and by issuing equity. And bank lending standards, while they're still quite tight, have begun to ease somewhat. As a result, we're actually seeing some measures of bank credit starting to expand again. The second positive is that monetary policy and fiscal policy have been working very hard to provide support to the recovery. On the monetary policy side at the Fed, we've maintained unusually low levels of short-term interest rates, and we've engaged in large-scale asset purchases, also referred to as quantitative easing, sometimes referred to as QE2. These measures have fostered a sharp improvement in financial market conditions. On the fiscal side, that's government spending and taxes, the economy has been supported by a shift in policy to help support growth. In particular, the temporary reduction in payroll taxes that was implemented at the beginning of the year could have an important impact on growth during the first part of 2011. And third, this is very much linked to the topic of this meeting and this following week, is growth abroad. Much of the rest of the world, especially in emerging market economies, have been growing quite rapidly. And this growth has led to an increase in the demand for U.S. goods and services, Over the four quarters of 2010, for example, real or inflation-adjusted exports rose at a 9.2% annual rate, so a very healthy increase. All told, if you look at the sources of growth in 2010, exports accounted for 40% of the actual growth that we saw last year, so very, very important in terms of the U.S. economic outlook. So to sum up, the firming in economic activity is due both to natural healing, so as we get further and further away from the crisis, balance sheets get repaired, and the past and present policy support that we're seeing from both monetary and fiscal policy. Now, in this regard, it's important to emphasize that we at the Federal Reserve have been expecting the economy to strengthen. That's been our forecast. We provided the additional monetary policy stimulus in the form of our asset purchase program to help ensure that the recovery gained more momentum. A stronger recovery with more rapid progress towards our dual mandate objective is what we're seeking. This is welcome, and the fact that we're finally starting to see evidence of this is not a reason to reverse course. Yet, you know, even though we are becoming a little bit more optimistic about the growth outlook, it's important not to become overly optimistic. The coast is clearly not completely clear. First of all, the healing process in the aftermath of a crisis takes time, and also there are several areas of vulnerability and weakness. In particular, in the United States, house prices have begun to soften again in many parts of the country. State and local government finances remain under stress, and this is likely to lead to further spending cuts, tax increases, or job losses in the sector that will offset at least part of the federal fiscal stimulus. Moreover, in recent weeks, we've experienced several shocks from abroad that could have some impact on the economy's forward momentum, at least in the short term. For example, higher oil prices cut into household purchasing power, and the tragedy in Japan is leading to supply disruptions that could dampen growth somewhat in the near term. Also, conditions in Japan, the Middle East, and North Africa remain uncertain and could worsen with negative implications for global economic growth. Furthermore, we can't ignore the fact that we still face significant challenges in the U.S., especially in terms of the long-term fiscal outlook. But in the near term, at least, the most immediate domestic problems seem more likely to recede then become more prevalent. On the housing side, stronger job growth should lead to more household formation. For example, more young people will be able, once they get jobs, to move out of their parents' homes. This trend should provide more support to housing demand over time. On the state and local side, a rising economy will boost sales and income tax receipts, and that will help narrow near-term fiscal shortfalls. Another thing that we have to be careful at the Fed is we have to be watchful that to ensure that the low interest rates that are in place right now don't foster a buildup of financial excesses or bubbles that might pose a medium-term risk to our objectives of full employment and price stability. So in this regard, we continue to monitor the effect of interest rates on risky assets, financial assets. An unusual sign of over-exuberance in the financial markets could signal that such risks were not being adequately addressed. So far, the differentials in terms of risky assets versus non-risky assets in the U.S. do not seem obviously out of line, but we are continuing to look at this. Now, on the inflation side of the ledger, the thing that we were worried most last summer, the risk of deflation, that risk has greatly diminished. At the moment, both total or headline inflation and core inflation, which excludes the volatile food and energy prices, have increased a bit over recent months, but they still remain below levels consistent with our dual mandate, which most members of the Federal Open Market Committee put at an inflation rate of 2% or a bit less on what's called the personal consumption expenditure measure. But it's important to recognize that that we are seeing a substantial rise in commodity prices and that this is likely to put further upward pressure on headline inflation in coming months because the increases are really concentrated in food and energy. Now, if the commodity price pressures level off around current levels, the effect on inflation will be a little bit of upturn and then it will come right back down, so nothing to be worried about. But we need to ensure that commodity price pressures do not persist and cause inflation expectations to become unmoored. If that were to occur, it would be more difficult for us to keep inflation in check. So we're really keeping a very close eye on inflation expectations to make sure that they stay well anchored. So to sum up, economic conditions have improved in the past year, yet the recovery is still somewhat tenuous. And we are still far from the mark with regard to the Fed's dual mandate. In particular, the unemployment rate is still at 8.8%, much too high. So now let me turn to discuss economic conditions in Puerto Rico. In contrast to the situation during my last visit about a year ago, I am pleased to see signs that the Commonwealth may finally be emerging from what was a very long and painful recession. Yet, even though we are seeing signs of recovery, we have to recognize that conditions still remain very difficult for many families. The recession here was deeper than the downturn in the mainland. By 2010, for example, total employment in Puerto Rico had fallen by 13%, or 138,000 jobs from the peak in 2005. That decline is almost double the 7% job loss that we saw on the mainland from the employment peak to the employment trough. Furthermore, the recession, as I mentioned, in Puerto Rico lasted for 5 years. That's about three times as long as the downturn on the mainland. And the recovery has been slower to arrive than what we've seen in the mainland. While the mainland recovery began in mid-2009, Puerto Rico's economy continued to decline for another year, to the middle of last year. But since then, there have been some promising signs. Recently released revisions suggest that job growth on the island, while still very weak, it wasn't as weak as what we thought last year, so it looks like things were not quite as bad as we feared. And most of the weakness that we've seen has not been broad-based. It's really concentrated primarily in two areas, construction and manufacturing. Moreover, the unemployment rate has come down by a full percentage point since its peak. However, I think we'd all agree that at 16%, it remains unacceptably high. Inflation in the Commonwealth has been generally subdued. There's been some volatility, but we had a period of falling prices in 2009. Then inflation picked up in late 2009. We actually saw annualized inflation rates of over 4% on the island for a few months. Medical care was the key driver of that. Since the middle of last year, inflation rates have been really in the 1% to 2% range, so not very different than what we've experienced on the mainland. However, the rise in food and energy prices that's occurred more recently is going to push inflation higher, so we'll probably see higher inflation in the Commonwealth over the next few months. Now, to help keep track of conditions in Puerto Rico, we're continuing to work on developing better economic statistics so we can actually monitor in real time what's happening on the island. We can now look at the Institute of Statistics' new Manufacturing Purchasing Managers Index, so that's referred to as the PRPMI. This is conducted in conjunction with the Puerto Rico Manufacturers Association and Scotiabank. And the survey shows that business conditions on the island were steady in January, following improvement at the end of 2010. Now, this index has signaled growth now for 7 of the past 9 months. It's a new index, so we don't have a long track record, so it may be not as quite reliable as it will be over time when we have more history, but it does start to show you that things are starting to look a little bit better. So what about credit conditions in Puerto Rico? How much debt do families have, and how have they been doing in terms of meeting their debt obligations? I don't have to tell you how important it has been to monitor these trends over the course of the Great Depression and its aftermath. The New York Fed has a new source of information with respect to seeing how families are doing called the Consumer Credit Panel. So we can actually now track families in the mainland and in Puerto Rico in terms of how they're doing in terms of managing their credit on a pretty timely basis. Overall, when we look at this and compare it to the mainland, Puerto Ricans avoided most of the boom and bust in terms of the use of household credit. So there wasn't the kind of subprime mortgage lending here on the island that caused a lot of the problems that we saw, especially in states like Nevada and California and Florida on the mainland. That said, the signs of distress, though, here are still readily apparent, and that's really primarily due to the fact that the island suffered such a long and deep recession. Unlike the mainland, households on the island did not raise their borrowing much in the run-up to the recession. So it's not surprising that Puerto Rico did not see the kind of sharp spike in loan delinquencies that many areas saw from late 2007 to early 2009. Instead, Puerto Rico's delinquencies on household debt, that's the portion of debt where payments are more than 90 days or more past due, has instead risen sort of gradually as the recession persisted. So in 2005, when the recession was just sort of starting, households were behind on about 5% of their total debt. And then in 2010, as the recession just ground on, the delinquency rate had climbed to about 9% of the debt. That's about the same as the national average. And that just reflects the stress that the recession put on families on the island. So what about the outlook looking forward in 2011 and beyond? Well, I see grounds for cautious optimism. In particular, exports, which have been so important to the economic recovery on the mainland, also have the potential to contribute to growth here in Puerto Rico as well. Currently, Puerto Rico runs a sizable trade surplus. It sells more products to the world than it buys. In 2009, that's the latest year that we have the data for the island, the value of exports was roughly $60 billion compared with imports of about $40 billion, so a pretty sizable trade surplus. Now, in terms of how are the exports doing, they're doing very similar to what's happening on the mainland. Through November of last year, which is the most recent data that we have, exports grew by about 10% in 2010, so pretty healthy growth rate of exports. So what does Puerto Rico export? Well, I visited one facility that exports a lot, Goya Foods. I think they're the second and third biggest exporter by container volume on the island. But if you sum up across different kinds of goods, pharmaceuticals remain the island's largest export. In addition to the Goya Foods that we saw, we also see medical equipment, computer and electronic products, and electrical equipment is also important as far as exports here. Now, in terms of who does Puerto Rico export to, the mainland is the primary trading partner. That accounts for about half of the island's imports and about three-quarters of its exports. There's many reasons why there's this tight trade link between Puerto Rico and the mainland. It's true that Puerto Rico does business with a lot of other economies, but for generations, the mainland and Puerto Rico have had a really special economic relationship. One of the most obvious of this is the common use of the dollar. This means that tourists from the mainland can visit here without having to change their currencies or worried about what their currencies are worth. And businesses can make investments in Puerto Rico, not worrying about whether they'll retain their competitiveness with people that they're competing with on the mainland, because obviously they're using the same currency, so they don't have to worry about the dollar moving around in value and then affecting their competitiveness. The island runs a surplus with the mainland. That accounts for most of the island's overall surplus. So if we see an economic recovery on the mainland, which we are starting to see, and if that starts to strengthen, that will definitely be good for the Commonwealth here. But Puerto Rico's export markets also extend overseas. Aside from the U.S. mainland, the top export markets for the island are Germany, the Netherlands, Belgium, and Spain. Exports to these four countries combined exceeded $11 billion in 2009, and they've been actually growing pretty rapidly. It grew 30% between 2007 and 2009, so quite a bit more penetration into Europe. The success that Puerto Rico has in selling its goods and services to industrial countries, I think, bodes well for the island's futures. As more emerging economies narrow the gap between themselves and the more developed countries, the market for Puerto Rico's goods could well expand accordingly. Going forward, I would not be surprised to see Puerto Rico's exports to rise further as your companies take advantage of the opportunities presented by the rapidly growing emerging economies. At your upcoming forum and summit, you'll learn more about how to develop export markets for your products. I applaud these efforts to do so. This is an important component, I think, for sustaining the vigor of an economic recovery here in Puerto Rico. Now, although the signs I've mentioned suggest that the recession is over, fingers crossed, the road to sustained economic growth is likely to be challenging in the near term. In its favor, Puerto Rico has some important intrinsic advantages. These include natural beauty, hospitable climate, unique status as a major U.S. economic and population center in the Caribbean. And just as important, the island has a relatively well-educated workforce. Research shows quite convincingly that high quality of human capital is a very important ingredient to have a thriving economy. We at the New York Fed aim to do our part to help sustain growth in the Commonwealth. Well, that was really one of the important parts of our discussions over the last day and a half. It was, what could the New York Fed do to be helpful? give you some examples of what we do. We co-sponsor a financial awareness video competition for college students here, and the Convenient Reinvestment Act Week activities with the Puerto Rican Bankers Association. And as a member of the Alliance for Economic and Financial Education, we promote economic and financial education via teacher training. We also focus on a high school economic competition and a speaker series. New York Fed is also engaged in several ongoing programs of technical assistance in Puerto Rico. We partner with other organizations throughout the year to help provide technical training for community development professionals. We cover the costs of two or three professors who are engaged in macroeconomic and monetary policy research here on the island to come up to New York to attend our annual symposium on current economic conditions that we have at the New York Fed. We also recognize that a healthy banking system and accurate economic statistics are both important components of having a favorable business climate. So to improve our understanding of the Puerto Rican economy, the New York Fed has joined a group of local businesses to sponsor and fund a household survey undertaken by the Center of the New Economy to benchmark Puerto Rican consumer finances. To help businesses and governments in Puerto Rico, we've also been providing technical assistance to Puerto Rico's new Institute for Statistics in launching the new monthly survey that I talked about earlier. We applaud this and other efforts to improve the measurement of what's really going on here in the island. As a financial regulator, the New York Fed works to help ensure that the financial system runs smoothly so that it can support economic growth. We are really working hard to prevent the type of financial crisis that we recently experienced from occurring in the future. We want a financial system that is financially stable, safe and sound, but one that does not inhibit businesses from growing and prospering. We are working closely with all of the banking supervisors and other key partners to facilitate an effective resolution to the problems facing the island's banking sector. Last year, some of the Puerto Rico banks were consolidated, and many improved their balance sheets by selling underperforming assets. Both of these steps are likely to produce stronger, healthier institutions that are more able to make sound lending decisions that are necessary to support economic growth. All of these activities, ranging from effective monetary policy, prudent financial regulation, fostering economic literacy, better measurement of what's going on in the economy, I think they all complement and reinforce each other and should help support a stronger economy in Puerto Rico. So let me sum up. The mainland economy experienced a pickup in activity during the second half of 2010, and that shows signs of continuing in 2011. The recovery in Puerto Rico has taken a bit longer to get off the ground, but now shows signs of, we're still starting to see early signs of recovery. On the mainland and in Puerto Rico, unemployment rate remains stubbornly high, but many indicators suggest that conditions are in place for stronger employment growth in coming months. With government and business leaders like yourself working together to build a better future for Puerto Rico, I am hopeful we will soon be able to look back at 2010 and see not only the end of the island's long recession, but also the beginning of an era of growth and prosperity for Puerto Rico. I want to thank you for your kind attention, and I would be very happy to take a few questions.
Good morning. My name is Raul Galla, Chairman of the Board of the Puerto Rico Chamber of Commerce. Bill, thank you for your interesting presentation. We're concerned, of course, with all the issues you brought up here. The focus on export here on the island is we're projecting or trying to platform the island as a seller to Latin America, which is in a very active situation of growth right now. From the United States and vice versa, project Puerto Rico to Latin America as a seller to the United States. How can you help us on these issues?
Well, I think the one thing that we're going to try to do is provide a little bit of unbiased, unpolitical, apolitical advice on what are the issues in Puerto Rico that are barriers to Puerto Rico's competitiveness. You know, try to understand really clearly what are the things that, you know, impediments that, you know, could be removed, and if you were to remove those impediments, that would improve Puerto Rico's competitiveness and then make it more effective in terms of achieving stronger export performance. So that's sort of our commitment in trying to you know, help identify the problems and what the potential solutions are the problems, so that so that we can actually push the discussion forward in a constructive manner.
Good morning. My name is Juma from Inter-American University. We have noticed that the employment in service sector is increasing more than in manufacturing sector in the United States. What do you think if we have in Puerto Rico an opportunity to outsource our knowledge, core competencies to near islands in the Caribbean or in American Latina, Latin American?
Well, I think, you know, this issue of service sector employment growing back faster than manufacturing employment, this is something that's been in place for literally decades. And what's really driving it is the fact that manufacturing productivity is quite a bit higher than productivity in the service sector. So we're getting more efficient faster in manufacturing. So I think it's fair to say that while manufacturing jobs are still important because, you know, they're often high paying, you know, it's probably not realistic to think that manufacturing employment growth is going to be a key driver of economic activity. You know, I think, you know, as I said in my speech, we're seeing the strongest manufacturing employment growth in the U.S. since the 1990s. But on an absolute basis, what's still driving employment growth in the U.S.? It's predominantly services. So manufacturing is important from a point of view of exports, and that. And those manufacturing jobs also have important ripple effects in the sense that, you know, if you hire someone who's producing and manufacturing, that employee then goes out and, you know, goes to restaurants, buys clothes, buys other services. And so there are spin-off effects in terms of service sector jobs. But really the key driver is probably going to be more the services side.
Time for one last short question. Yes, please.
Although you mentioned that you're cautiously optimistic about Puerto Rico's economy, you talk as if the recession ended. Do you think it has really ended?
Well, I would say that you know, the tentative signs suggest that it may have ended. But I think the tenor of your question is correct. I mean, you know, it looks better. It's stabilized to rising. You know, seven of the 9 months that we've had the PMI have shown growth. So that does suggest a turn, but it's still quite fragile. And so, you know, this is something that we have to keep our fingers crossed that we're not quite out of the woods yet. One of the biggest risks for the island, of course, is probably what's going to actually happen to oil prices. That's a risk for the mainland as well, but the island is a little bit more exposed to oil prices, partly because, you know, electric power here on the island all is fueled, you know, almost all that electric power is fueled by oil, and that's not the case on the mainland. The second important difference in terms of the energy prices is U.S. mainland produces a lot of oil and gas itself. So when oil prices go up on the mainland, it's a negative, but it's not as big a negative because there's some people getting income from the higher oil prices, and that stimulates more oil and gas drilling and activity, which provides some offset. So I think, you know, the one thing that I'd be focused on the island, which nothing you can do about it, but is what happens to oil prices. So the developments in the Middle East and North Africa, I think, are going to be a very, very important wild card for the island.
Well, we'll keep you on track and keep us on track.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.